Bill Twipe with the Director's Office, and another one of the things I work on for the agency is the policy lead for aquatic invasive species, and I'm our agency's representative on the Washington Invasive Species Council, which I currently have the pleasure of chairing. Alan is our unit lead on aquatic invasive species. He is our technical lead for the agency, works very extensively with comparable units in other states and provinces as well, and as part of the regional team that's keeping the Northwest free of zebra and quagga mussels and helping keep our state free of various invasive species. We thought this would be a great opportunity to do two things. First off, we're in the midst of a fairly major effort to work with stakeholders and then obviously report back to the legislature on obtaining a stable long-term funding package, and that'll be the latter part of our presentation. But as long as we were doing that, we thought it'd be a good opportunity to give you just an overview of the kinds of challenges that Alan's been facing over the last few years and the current state of the AAS unit budget and capabilities. So it's really a three-part presentation.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the Commission. We'll get started here with the presentation. So as Bill was saying, there's three parts. We'll talk about the aquatic invasive species and the ballast water management programs, the both those programs' budgets, and then Bill will follow up with the funding advisory committee process. The core functions of the aquatic invasive species and the ballast water management programs are basically prevention, early detection, rapid response, infested site management, local regional coordination, education outreach, and enforcement. These are just some of the species that we've been dealing with and some of the pathways, and we'll focus in on some of those in a bit. Some of the pathways that come into Washington State, again, we're talking about aquatic invasive species, and in our department, it's aquatic animal invasive species. So everything from large ships bringing in ballast water, float planes, people that are dumping their aquariums, fouled boats, both in water and that are transported overland, attempts earlier in our history to introduce species for economic purposes, such as nutria. And as well as the upper part there, there's a bunch of school children who are doing wonderful things out in the wild, but are they cleaning their boots between efforts? So they could, just like our own staff, could be transporting invasive species from place to place, and we need to think about those pathways. The big one that we are all aware of and our biggest risk in Washington State are zebra and quagga mussels. These are graphic images, the top ones from the Great Lakes areas of the inundations that these species can impact. And the lower left one is a 3-inch PVC pipe that took about 6 months for it to get to that stage. They're really excessively rapid growth. They'll grow on anything of hard surface, including crayfish or other mussels. And we are the last area in the continental United States to be free of these zebra and quagga mussels. So what are the risks? The risks are primarily to our hydroelectric facilities, municipal water supplies, agriculture, irrigation, anything that has a pipe or a way that water has to flow through, these things will clog up and cause enormous amounts of damage, hundreds of millions per year, as well as natural resources. So, for example, if they can get into the fish ladders on the dams, these shells are very sharp and they could lacerate and injure both the adults going up as well as juveniles coming back down. Another recent one that came in is African clawed frogs, and they also brought in a very nasty amphibian virus called ranavirus. This is a joint effort that we're working with the city of Lacey at this time on, and there's some stormwater ponds. We're doing dewatering of the ponds. We're doing intensive trapping, seining, a multiple interdisciplinary effort being going on here. The lower left is our department veterinarian, Katie Heyman. She's doing samples of the frogs, looking for the different diseases and such. And the lower right is decontamination, so we don't want to spread this around. So it's a massive effort that's going on. This is the first detection in the Pacific Northwest for both the frogs and for the ranavirus. The ranavirus itself is known to affect 72 amphibian species and has up to 100% kill rate. It's a crossover virus. It can also infect other amphibians, fish, and reptiles. It's suspected to have caused die-offs in fish and reptiles worldwide. So this is a really nasty one, and it's been a joint effort within the department to contain the situation and work towards an eradication. Another one that you've heard about are Japanese tsunami marine debris. Here's some examples of the larger debris that's come in, primarily skiffs. The in all of U.S. and Canada, and this was as of earlier or in 2014, there's been a couple more since then, but about 24 boats have landed in Washington itself and 15 alone in 2014. What are the risks of the tsunami marine debris? Well, so far we've detected over 250 individual species, not native to Washington State, that have come up on these debris. Millions of individual species on some of the debris, and many species are in reproductive state. Species not found on earlier debris are still arriving. So it's been a pretty slow year for tsunami debris. We had about three boats come in last spring, and then it's been very, very dry, so to speak, for debris. With the new storms coming in, perhaps we're going to get some more of the larger debris, but most of the smaller parts of the tsunami debris have already either come ashore or somewhere, or they've been, you know, sunk. But we still know that there's still some of these larger debris out there, like these skiffs. Another area that our program works on is ballast water, and we get about 4,100 vessel arrivals every year. We have two vessel inspectors that do about 315 inspections per year. In total of those 4,100 vessel arrivals, they discharge about 15.1 million cubic meters of discharge. That's an incredible amount of water. And one of the things that our inspectors do is we have taken samples in the ballast tanks of these ships, and these are the basic categories of species that you could find in any of these ballast tanks. Everything from larvae to zooplankton, phytoplankton, viruses, and bacteria. So what are the risks involved with this? There's risk to the commercial and recreational shellfish industry. So, for example, one of the bacteria is cholera. So if this vessel had a load of water that had cholera in it and discharged next to a commercial shellfish bed or in that area, there could be some serious consequences. Salmon recovery is an issue. The zooplankton that are in here that our small salmon juveniles eat are changing. We've had some detections in some areas where the zooplankton species have changed from a native to a non-native in those areas. Rockfish recovery, harmful algal blooms could be being caused by these. And again, for example, the bacteria and the viruses are also could contribute to human health risks. Yes, sir.
Do you treat the ballast water at all, or do you just sample it?
We do not treat the ballast water. The ballast water is, there's two methods that they, the current method is a ballast water exchange. So when a vessel leaves a port, it's supposed to go out at least 200 nautical miles if it's a transoceanic voyage and discharge that water and take on open ocean water. If it's a coastal voyage, they go out 50 nautical miles and do the same thing. The regulations are switching to a treatment-based so that they will be treating any uptake, and there's a multiple ways that they can do that. And that's one of the areas that we're in this transition between the exchange and treatment. And this gives you a brief timeline of how the program and ballast water management has taken place since the late 1980s, early 90s. Until currently, and so right now, the use of ballast water exchange is intended to decline as more vessels put on treatment systems. These treatment systems are very expensive. They can cost $1 to $3 million just for the treatment system. And there's a number of areas that are going on, so that's a risk gap there. So exchange risk factors in this period are changing regulations. The state of Washington requires the coastal exchange. The federal government does not, and so we want to maintain that. We inspect vessels using a different risk priority system than the Coast Guard does. And the Coast Guard has other regulations. So it's really important for our program to maintain in order to alleviate those risks. As we transition to the treatment, there has been delays in the federal typing approvals of the systems. And again, there's a different ballast water vessel inspection profile that they use. At this time, we have not seen any federal inspection protocols for the treatment system, and no biological sampling protocols for these are in evidence at this point either. So as the treatment systems come into place, we will be evaluating how our program works and how we need to evolve, or possibly that the federal government will take over the substantive management of that risk at a satisfactory level. But we estimate that that's going to be at least 5 to 10 years before we have a definitive answer to that. This is a basic invasive ecology diagram that basically says, the earlier you can do your work, the less expensive it will be. So before an introduction, to prevent an introduction, you do things like education outreach, you do things like watercraft inspections and other things to prevent them from coming in and getting into the waters. Once they get into the water, then you have your first one is try to eradicate them in a rapid response. That's something, for example, with the African clawed frogs that we're trying to do. Get in there and get them out as quickly as possible. If that's not successful, then you have containment and on towards long-term management. And as you keep moving in that direction, the costs increase. So in Washington State, we had a recent work done by a group, and they looked at some of the marine invasive histories, and it just shows that instead of plateauing off or decreasing, we are still getting an increased number of new non-native species being established in our marine environment. And so the risk is not decreasing, and we need to be vigilant. So the state funding history, back in 2005, the legislature approved a new watercraft registration fee of $2 per registration. And they also passed they provided a new AIS ballast water general fund budget. Combined, that was about $640,000 a year. In 2007, the legislature gave us an additional amount specifically for ballast water. That actually allowed us to have two vessel inspectors full-time. And then 2014 was a big year for us to get a new chapter in our RCWs passed. That was a really amazing and really appreciated effort by everybody. We did have a $3 million ask associated with that initially, and by the end of the legislative session, all funding parts had been removed from the bill. And we got our policy, and we've been looking for that money since. So in 2015, this last year, we thought about trying to neck it down and do it in a phased approach. So instead of $3.8 million just for the AIS program, we came in at a $1.1 million ask. And then we also included a $1.1 million ask for ballast water as well. In 2014, we were not asking any new monies for ballast water, but we did in 2015. Both of those asks did not make it to the legislature, but we did get a $300,000 biennium bridge funding proviso. And part of that proviso was to fund a funding advisory committee to look into what would be an equitable, fair, reasonable funding mechanism for the aquatic invasive species. This is just a brief history of our funding since back in 1998 when the program began. And the blue lines are basically all the funds, which include what you would consider, stable base funding, as well as in the case of the AIS, the watercraft fee would be considered that stable base funding, and everything above that would be soft money contracts and such. Same thing with the ballast water on below. The GIS AI-ALIA was our base funding, and that above that, it would be considered soft funding contracts and such.
AIS work is very expensive. As Alan showed you with that one curve, it doesn't have to be as expensive if you can catch it early, if you can catch it early in the prevention stage. But even prevention work requires a lot of cooperation and a lot of assistance. So it requires money going into outreach and education. It also requires some money at least going into enforcement of our current statutes. As a state, we have great statutes. In 2014, we got those reworked. So we have all the authorities that we need at this point. We just don't have the resources to use those authorities. And that's going to ultimately end up being in a very expensive place for the state to be if there aren't some changes. It's an interesting issue for us because as we work with the legislature on this, we actually have some pretty strong support from folks who we don't always think of as our allies. A lot of the legislators, key legislators from the interior, from Eastern Washington, for instance, really get the issues. They're particularly concerned about the potential impacts of zebra or quagga mussels coming into Washington and the impacts that that would have on our hydroelectric system, on irrigation, on agriculture in general. And they also understand that prevention is by far and away the cheapest. We're able to work with groups like Pacific Northwest Economic Region, with the Northwest Power and Conservation Council and other regional bodies, Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, to mount these regional efforts. Our legislators are often engaged in that. So we've got a good, strong core of legislative support, but it hasn't been enough to get us over the hoop. And I think you're all very, very aware of the challenges the legislature continues to face. But it's often the urban Ds or the west side Ds that end up at the end not being able to make us a high enough priority to fit in. And so as Alan showed you already, in spite of the fact that challenges continue to increase, and they will forever, the AIS world is one of always increasing challenges. As more and new vectors, ways of moving AIS around, become obvious to us, and who knew that the Japanese tsunami would end up being a vector for marine invasive species, but it was a very real one. It's very hard to budget for things like that, even when you don't know when the next vector is going to be coming at you. Who knew African clawed frogs would carry the Raina virus and all of a sudden pose a very, very real and large threat to our native amphibians? So it's having the ability to first off work, continue to work on prevention, but then also the ability to rapidly respond does require more funding than we currently have. We're not keeping pace with where we want to be. We're also not keeping pace as a state with the other Western states. Several of the other Western legislators, and most recently Montana, have provided some fairly large funding increases. And again, our legislators are aware of that. We'll talk a little bit about what some of the tools are about that in just a moment. But the place at this point, our only stable funding comes from the recreational boaters. They've been paying for this program from the beginning, and they continue to support this program. They have strong political support, but they're also not interested in being the only group, the only possible vector that is paying for this. And from where we sit, that's very fair. AIS are all of our problem. It's not just recreational boaters that move them around, and we all benefit collectively from minimizing their impact on the state, not just recreational boaters.
What agency is responsible for invasive aquatic vegetation? And I'm just asking.
It's the Department of Agriculture has the regulatory authority, and Department of Ecology does the management, and they offer a grant program for people that want to get rid of the plants out of their area.
So is there opportunity for, like, joint funding or, you know, working with those agencies?
So all state agencies cooperate and work collaboratively through the State Invasive Species Council. Each agency still is responsible for their own budgets, although the council has been very supportive as a council of this agency's budgetary proposals. ultimately, the answer is each agency needs the funding to perform our primary role, and then we all work together best. But we certainly always are looking for ways to partner with the other agencies, as well as partner with our sister agencies throughout the region in order to get the job done as effectively and cheaply as possible. But as we'll show you in a moment, we're a long ways from where we need to be. It's not a small matter of just a little bit of extra cooperation. We've got a big gap ahead of us, and Alan will cover that.
Just as an example, you say you have two people that monitor or patrol to look for invasive species on boats, I assume.
That's the larger vessels, the ocean-going shipping vessels. We have two ballast water inspectors.
For 4,000 landings every year.
To cover the Columbia River, the coast, and Puget Sound. Correct. Now, we get a lot of cooperation from industry itself. One of our biggest jobs is actually sort of just catching the rogues, the ones, the parts of the industry that aren't following all the standards well. But even the good players, they got a million things to deal with on board those large vessels when they come in, and they don't always even do it right. So keeping them on their toes and keeping education, it's our two inspectors are spread pretty thin.
So as Bill was saying, we'll talk a little bit about regional budget comparisons. The Pacific Northwest Economic Region, PENWAR, estimated that the costs associated with failing to prevent an invasion of dreicenids, this is just the zebra and quagga mussels alone, in the Pacific Northwest exceeds half a billion annually, or 500,000 annually. And so in comparison, looking at these western states, and earlier I said 3.8 million was our ask just for aquatic invasive species, and a lot of people sort of just take a step back and go, wow, that's a big number. But as you look at as comparison to what other states are spending, and how we rank at this point, again, just for the zebra quagga mussels, we're fairly low on that level. And one of the things you need to think about when you compare our state to the others is, how much watercraft use, how much water recreational, freshwater marine waters. So Minnesota doesn't have the marine waters, unique water areas, AIS, the different pathways, how much hydropower that we have that some of these other states don't have, what is our risk-based irrigation, salmon recovery. These are the big things. And so what is a reasonable amount of money in order to prevent harm to those things as compared to what other states are doing? So when you talk about ballast water, we're a little bit higher up on the ranking, but again, as compared to California, we have a very limited budget. And again, thinking about what is the comparative factors here, the number of arrivals, we actually, our vessels, even though we have fewer numbers of vessel arrivals in California, our vessels discharge more ballast water into our state than they do into California. That's because we're more of an export state and they're more of an import state. So vessels come in unladen with cargo, but laden with ballast water in our state more often. Things like that. So what we came up with and what we've been working with the legislature on is to say that our current funding combined aquatic invasive species and ballast water is about $850,000 a year. What we're proposing is a budget that's $5.2 million a year combined. That would be a little over $3 million for the aquatic invasive species, plus a $1 million AIS local grant program. That would be similar to what they do with the aquatic vegetation. So we encourage the local governments, landowners and stuff, to be able to do more local management rather than having the state come in. And this is a very, very popular idea out there.
Reasons that is so important is as we're seeing elsewhere in the West and we're beginning to see in our state as well, a lot of different governmental entities feel like they've got a lot at risk, particularly, again, the agriculture sector, but also the water supply sector feel like they have a lot at risk. And when they don't see the state doing a good job of prevention, and when they don't see the state as having the capability to do the rapid response they're concerned about, they take matters into their own hands. just this year in southern Idaho, one of the major irrigation districts began the process of closing off their waters to public access. The city of Bellingham now for 2 years has run their own inspection and permitting program on their primary water supply, Lake Whatcom. We get that. We understand why folks do that. But when you look at that from the perspective of somebody who's interested in maintaining broad-scale access to recreational boating, for hunting or fishing, if each of these areas begins to establish their own program requiring their own permit or their own sticker with their own somewhat unique regulations, we're going to lose a lot of ground really, really quickly. The recreational boating organizations of Washington understand that. They're extremely concerned about proliferation, and that's part of the reason why the local grant idea is very, very appealing. And the idea there is instead of forcing individual municipalities or utility districts or others to set up their own programs, if the state would establish a local grant program to allow them to supplement the state's efforts, but without requiring additional fees, following state protocols so that when you go there, you know what to expect. You don't have to worry about a special set of regulations for an individual water body. So that adds at least $1 million to this price tag. We're pretty sure that assuming this is successful, within a couple of years, it actually could be a much bigger program than that. When we think about just the city of Bellingham's program alone, that could eat up a fair amount of that, probably a third of that just in the first year, and that's just one municipality. But as Alan said, it's for that reason. It's a very popular idea, and it's something we think is essential to a long-term program, is that kind of local grant approach, helping the local entities develop protections that meet their needs, but without turning it into a whole other set of barriers to outdoor recreation and outdoor access.
So just like when you come back from Costco or the mall and you look at your bill and you go, I can't believe it costs that much, and it really wasn't that extravagant a purchase, you know, I think about $5.2 million is just, it sets me back and saying, boy, but it's really, we try to gear this as a moderate, proactive program. We're not looking at being higher than that. And it's prevention focused, and it's comparable with the other states and the other risks that they're showing out there.
So our process, it's been, as I mentioned, it's been an exercise in frustration. And a large part of the reason for that has been that a lot of the things that we're describing are really general fund obligations in a lot of ways. A lot of people contribute to their spread, and a lot of people benefit from the prevention of their spread. But general fund just isn't what it used to be. And the legislature more and more for these kinds of issues has been turning to user fees. And so this agency has been engaged in user fee discussions with a broad range of stakeholders for several years now. The problem in our approach has been we've sort of been talking to one user group at a time. And I'm sure you can imagine the results of that. The user group nods very sympathetically, says, yeah, big problem. We really strongly support you, and they ought to be paying, pointing to the people who aren't in the room. And that's gotten us nowhere over the last couple of years. Again, this is funded now by one user fee primarily, and that's the recreational watercraft fees. And they're interested and willing to continue paying their share, but they're not interested in the kind of increase it would take to fund this. And they argue pretty quickly, if we're going user fees, let's get all the users in the room, both beneficiaries as well as some of the other vectors. So what we proposed to the 2015 legislature, when it became clear that they weren't going to be able to get to a long-term funding source, we proposed two things. One, give us a bit of a bump, bridge funding, and Alan's already described that. And two, direct us to work with Recreation and Conservation Office through the State Invasive Species Council to pull together a task force of stakeholders to work with us to develop long-term funding recommendations. And the idea is to get all the stakeholders in the room at the same time so that it's not as easy to point to the folks who aren't in the room to develop a set of long-term funding recommendations. So we're right in the middle of that right now, and that's what we wanted to describe to you. Hopefully we'll be able to come back to you as part of developing the legislation proposals for next year with a set of budget proposals that are supported by that task force. So we've spent the fall working with the Invasive Species Council to establish the Funding Advisory Committee task force. We've got 15 folks who are willing to volunteer their time to work with us, and you can see the breadth of who we've been able to engage there. We're very, very pleased with the kind of response we got. We've had two of the four meetings that we're planning for this. The third one is next week up in Seattle. And we put in front of them an initial array of 36 options, as well as asking for any of their own, and they've been sort of winnowing their way through that. We started, though, that process by trying to develop a set of common principles. And, again, we were very pleased to get consensus out of the task force about these principles. And I'm not going to go through all these, but they very strongly understand the need for sufficiency. While they haven't bought on to that overall $5 million-plus budget per year, they get it that that's roughly in the ballpark, that the state is really underfunded. And it does need to be sufficient. They also understand that it needs to be stable and reliable. It can't be something that moves up and down over budgetary cycles, that this kind of effort requires building an infrastructure within the agency that's capable of essentially changing on a dime, switching from dealing with tsunami debris to dealing with whatever the latest threat that appears overnight is. It does need to be equitable. All the stakeholders, to the greatest extent possible, need to help pitch in through one form of funding or another. And they get that it needs to be implementable. And implementable doesn't mean everybody decides, okay, this really is a general fund obligation and punts it back to the legislature, because we know that's not going to be implementable. So we're hoping to wrap this up by January, and then have a report to this agency by February. That should allow us time to sync up with some of the other budget work we're doing through the Washington Wild Future and as well working through our normal budgeting process in order to have recommendations ready. The other thing that we're really hoping for is that we're also building a legislative lobbying team at the same time that folks have given us their input on appropriate funding. We're hoping for enough buy-in from enough of the task force members that it won't be just us in front of the legislature. But if we can have the breadth of stakeholders who are concerned with this working this issue with us, we think that may help too. It's not a big push in terms of the legislature. As I mentioned earlier on, we have a lot of sympathy, we have a lot of understanding, and we have a lot of concern about our current inadequate abilities already there in the legislature. But as you well know, when it gets late in the session, those things don't matter quite as much as they do early in the session, and what we need is kind of durable solution that we can hold together all the way through, and that's where having support of industry, support of affected stakeholders and others is going to be extremely important. So far, we really like what we're seeing out of the group, so we're pretty excited about it. Hope we can hold it together.
Thank you, Bill. Now, questions from the committee? Mr. Carpenter.
The situation in Whatcom County with what they've done is not at all popular with the recreational boating community. It's probably popular with the Whatcom County tax rolls. But anybody that, you know, Whatcom County has some very significantly good bodies of water to freshwater fishing in. Mm-hmm. And people come from all over the state and go into Whatcom County and go to one of their really nice lakes and find out, oh, it's Saturday and I can't get a permit. And it costs $45, I remember, right, the last time. It may have changed now.
It's about 50
bucks. So it's not well received, and again, it's just piling on the backs of the recreational boating community. And people come from out of Whatcom County who don't have a clue that they have to do that. And some vacationers, et cetera, have stopped by my day job and vented. So hopefully we can come up with a better template if we go in some kind of a statewide plan, hopefully.
Well, we think that the two elements that will help that are, first off, improved WDFW capabilities are going to – you'll have fewer local jurisdictions feeling as vulnerable as Bellingham currently feels. So the more they can rely on us, the less they're going to feel like they need to take it into their own hands. That's the first element. And the second element really is that local grant program. If we and Bellingham would have signed up for this in a heartbeat. One of the strongest supporters right now for this whole package is the city of Bellingham because of that local grant program in there. If they'd been able to take advantage of a local grant program instead of having to set up their own program, they would have done it just like that. And they get it. They hear all the same complaints you hear. They don't want to be in the position of making it more difficult for recreational boaters, for anglers, or for others. But they feel like their back is against the wall. They know the numbers. If zebra or quagga mussels become established in Bellingham's water supply, they know what the bill will be year after year after year forever. And it's very large. You often end up having to build a duplicate system. Almost all the Southern California water supply districts all now have two identical systems. They take one down and clean it while the other one's working. And about the time they get one cleaned and up again, the other one's already clogged and it's time to take it down.
You got the ball, Bill.
Mm-hmm. One question. You know, I've been aware of the zebra mussel problem for mm-hmm. quite a few years now because it was part of a program where enforcement would distribute brochures at the boat launches. And I haven't seen that for a while. I'm sure the materials are dated. There's other issues that we've become aware of. But I thought that was a good program. You know, they caught the boaters, you know, where you find them, and that's coming on and off the water. And I didn't know if that program was still going or not.
With the decline in funding, we're not able to have that as much of that emphasis. I mean, not only are we not gaining ground, we've actually been losing ground in funding. You saw that high water mark. It's now been over 5 years ago since, and even that, as we showed you, we think is not enough. But we've definitely seen that some decline. We do have... we've got a lot of partners. All three public utility districts with dams on the main stem Columbia all have AIS programs as part of their license, and that includes okay. the requirement for them to do outreach and education. They work closely with Allen on those materials so that all the materials say the same thing, mm-hmm. provide the same message. And, in fact, the license provisions for all three were designed closely with Allen in order to ensure that. So we get that kind of cooperation from others, but it's still, it's not the same as, and that covers limited areas as well.
Well, you know, and again, that's public information. It's not prevention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot of people aware.
A large part of prevention is education and outreach.
Yeah.
But it's not the only part.
The potential problem and risks, yeah. but it didn't.
We also need inspections, and our inspection rate has fallen off. It's not commensurate with the other states in the West at this point.
It seems to me, even back then, that there had been at least, and I can't remember the exact number of boats, that had been discovered carrying those mussels into the state and were decontaminated.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
it was working, but is that program active now?
Most of those vessels that were found to be contaminated were found on the roadways. So
right.
the check stations, not at the boat launches, but at you know choke points on routes, as well as finding them at the port of entry stations with Washington State Patrol, commercially hauled watercraft. Those are some of the bigger vectors. The other states since then have picked up a lot and done a lot more of the inspections. So we get referrals. Basically, there's a vessel coming through being hauled. Different states have different laws, so they can't detain them, and they just say, heads up, they're heading your way. So then we intercept them when they come into our state, and then we do a full decontamination of those boats. Yeah, again, it's the priorities are to find those and do those rapid response work at the roadside inspection stations. And as we can do boat side, you know, education outreach, we try to accomplish that. The enforcement officers, whenever they make a stop on the water, they talk about aquatic invasive species. So we try to spread it out as much as possible. Unfortunately, that's one of those areas with limited resources. We focus on early detection, and the roadside check stations are our primary methods at this point.
Thanks, Alan.
As you did, Bill, as well, growing up in the Great Lakes area, I remember when there were no zebra mussels. And now you can put an artificial substrate down and within a very short period of time have a colonization rate of 30,000 per meter. Yeah. It's just – so minimize this is a foolish practice.
The ecology of the Great Lakes has changed totally.
And to think, again, it can't happen here. It is, and it will.
The ecology of San Francisco Bay has changed totally. Over 90% of the biomass in San Francisco Bay is introduced plankton. There's very little native plankton there. Just imagine our salmon trying to adapt to all of a sudden having to forage with a completely different food source if Puget Sound were to go through a similar transformation. These things are game-changing at the ecosystem level.
Yeah, exactly, and because you talked about the water supply and all of that, the intake pipes, that's true. But each one of those little bivalves can filter like a liter in no time. You're changing basically everything in the water column. Yeah.
They leave the toxic bacteria for the others, so.
Yeah, they're little toxic bombs. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? No? Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.